Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hey, welcome to the Apparatus Architects. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, both from very, very cold areas in different locations within New York State, and we're really fortunate to kick off our first podcast of 2012 in January with a guest, Mr. Don Gutkill. Don is the fleet manager for not only fire apparatus, but for everything in the municipal fleet in Brandon Township, Pennsylvania. Don's been a good friend of Mike and mine over a number of years. And in addition to seeing the apparatus in the municipal fleet, Don's a certified EVT. And a lot of the issues that many of our listeners probably face and maybe occasionally crop up with when you're left scratching your head, Donnie probably sees that on a regular basis. So, Don, welcome to the show, and we're very happy to have you here.
Well, thank you, Tom and Mike. Glad to be here.
So we're going to start out with Mike's going to give us a quick rundown of just a couple of things that have happened, some that you want to open up the scrapbook and make sure you post it in the nonfiction section. But, Mike, what do you got for us?
Thanks, Tom, and Happy New Year, everybody, our first podcast of the new year. First, good news on the line-of-duty death front. Initial statistics have been released, and we have gone from 87 line-of-duty deaths in 2010, and we've dropped 7 down to 81 in 2011. Again, these are initial statistics, and they may tend to change as state fire marshals report in and they get the rest of the information. What's a really good news, for the first time in a very, very, very long time, the line-of-duty death rate from driving accidents is down to single digits, and again, in the early reporting here, there were just 3 line-of-duty deaths behind the wheel. That is substantially less than any number in the past decade, and perhaps it would lead one to believe that the work of trainers and teachers and the fact that the apparatus are built much better now than they ever have been before, and some of the safety initiatives that have been incorporated in the apparatus, such as emergency vehicles, stabilization control, ESC, emergency stabilization control units, and airbags, and better seat belts, and four-door enclosed cabs have finally, after all these years, paid dividends, and we have substantially less in the way of line-of-duty deaths behind the wheel, and that's very good news to kick off our year. Going to the Internet, as we talk about emergency stability control systems on the apparatus, there have been any number of recalls from different manufacturers. Check our website, emergencyvehiclerresponse.com, with the latest list of years, makes that have been affected by the recall of ESC. Also, this month on the website, there was a video from Australia that showed a pumper tanker running through a flood up to past the dashboard, and then that was put on YouTube. And I guess the people that did that thought it was funny, but their bosses certainly didn't, and they are now looking at punitive action for that. And finally, on a sad note, we do start the new year with a line-of-duty death in one of the Canadian provinces. A young man, 24 years old, flipped a fire truck and was killed right after the first of the year. So our heartfelt sympathies go out to that fire department and that firefighter's family. And now to our guest, Mr. Donnie Gutshaw. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. Well, for our listeners, Donnie, if you don't mind, just give us a little bit of background for the people that aren't you know, familiar like Mike and I are with, you know, your operations in Hamden Township and where you're located there in Cumberland County, just as they call it on the West Shore, from Harrisburg. Give us a little, listeners a little background about not only the apparatus, your apparatus fleet in Hamden Township, but the other, you know, municipal vehicles that you oversee with the folks in your shop.
Sure, Tom. We're the largest municipality in Cumberland County, and if people don't know the Pennsylvania political backgrounds, we're a township. We have covered 23 square mile, approximately 30,000 residents, over 121 miles of roads, and we operate with four engines, a truck, and a heavy rescue. And our mix is, we got some industrial feed mills, a lot of warehousing. Of course, your suburban areas, we got some very high-end residential structures, and two major interstates go through us, Interstate 81 and Interstate 581. So we have the big mix of a little bit of everything, plus a railroad. And our municipal fleet, we got over 450 pieces of equipment in the whole fleet, and that's including our plus the three ambulances we run.
Donnie, how long have the arrangements been? Because it is, believe it or not, somewhat unique. I think at least the approach as compared to departments in New York and New Jersey and a lot of other places, well, while you are a township and it's a township fire department, very candidly, it is kind of unique. And I think to the credit of whoever set this up, that your shops also maintains and oversees the fire apparatus. I think more commonly, the fire department's kind of left to their own devices to, you know, figure it out either using in-house sources or, you know, outside vendors or contractors. So how long has that been in place where you and your folks have overseen the maintenance of the apparatus, I guess, is the A part. And then the B part, maybe explain a little bit just your basic maintenance philosophy and how often the engines, the truck, and the squad, you know, come into your shop to be looked at.
Well, Tom, about 22 years ago, we had a very progressive fire chief here, and he went to the Board of Commissioners, who more or less are the governing body, the political division, and approached him and wanted a separate mechanic just to handle the fire department fleet. And that's how it all started back then, because of the cost they were running up sending the equipment out. And they wanted a more personal, you know, somebody in-house to take care of the equipment. I've been here 18 years plus. I was not the first mechanic, but I have gradually taken care of that. I was an emergency vehicle technician, and through the years now I've become the fleet manager, and I still oversee all that.
So is there, with the way this is set up, Donnie, then, is there, for budgetary purposes then, is it on the fire department side, or is it under your budget that there's some dollar figure allocated for the apparatus maintenance?
It comes out of the general fund, and it's a budgetary figure that we figure out each year that goes towards the fire department. EMS gets a certain budgetary. Police has the same a certain amount of money they allot me to spend for maintenance along with the rest of the fleet. So each department has a set figure that they budget towards. I try to give input, but being politically set, I'm more or less given a number. Here's what I'm going to have to work with for the year.
Okay, so let's take any one of the four engines, you know, barring an accident or something where they would write up a ticket and say, hey, you know, for example, they did a weekly check maybe in the station, and they note that there's an issue with the primer, you know, on engine 430. Other than something, an occasion like that, how often do you see the vehicles on your schedule come into your shop for PM work, and what types of things are you looking at, or tips that you might have for our listeners if they're trying to, you know, get something going for problem areas that you've noted that you think should be addressed?
Well, Tom, I've been pretty lucky. Pennsylvania requires a state inspection once a year on all emergency vehicles. Now, on anything over 17,000 pounds, it's twice a year. So all the apparatus gets in here once a year, or I watch the hours, and every 250 hours it gets a major PM. And as you were alluding to, every time there's a write-up, we bring the rig in, go over it, and of course we check the brakes and any safety issues we check out and make sure everything's good before it goes back out of the shop.
So when you look at, I mean, the size of the fire department fleet's rather modest compared to, obviously, when you mentioned the number of units that you have in the municipal fleet, how many mechanics do you have, you know, in your shop to cover, you know, the work on everything that you're responsible for?
Well, it's me, and I have another mechanic and a small engine mechanic, and we take care of the whole fleet. Now, we're assigned out of the maintenance pool. They have a maintenance division. There's two guys that have a mechanical background, and under our direct supervision, they assist us. And that's when we're allowed to have them, put it that way. So basically,
okay,
three of us take care of them, all that equipment.
All right. So with the rig thing coming in, you said based on the GVW, where they have to come in twice a year, and based on the hours, just to go to that, I think you mentioned, correct me if I'm wrong, Donnie, 250 hours. For the benefit of our listeners, how did you come up with that, you know, that time interval, and in practice, what does that equate to? Again, understanding that, you know, your department's probably quite busy with the the units being on the road. How did that come about?
Well, Tom, I came from a transportation background, and that was the number we used for years, 250 hours. And that equates roughly about 1 month of running heavy.
Okay.
And now our dump trucks don't get that on in a year's time, unless it's a really bad year of snow. So we just watch, and we keep a good eye on everything. That's how we do it.
Okay. With how much does the department rely upon you and your expertise, Don, for when it comes time to buy a new piece of apparatus? Do they come to you to look for specific input on components? As in, you know, beyond the obvious of engines, transmissions, and axles, but when it gets to specific things, and this has always intrigued me, if you're working with a department and they have some influence from an outside party, they will recommend, for example, a certain brand or model of alternator, and in some cases it's very valid, other cases it's based on their experience, again, that you would have on the fleet side, or batteries, or things like that. What kind of input do you have in those areas?
Well, when it comes to speccing a new piece of apparatus, I have a major input on it. The fire department will come to me and the fire administration officer, which we have, and give us their wish list. And then we have an apparatus committee. We sit down, a couple representatives of the fire company and the fire administration officer and myself, and we basically spec the rig out. Now, I go by components and performance is my biggest for my side. I want to make sure the rig does what it's supposed to do, and I try to spec components that I also have on the municipal side. So, say tires. I try to get the same tire sizes, and I run heavy on the tires. That way my stock is down so I can keep the cost of operation down. The same with alternators. But now on alternators, because the time span of the vehicles, as you know, there's so many variables from 1 year to the 3 years later. Power steering, we use the manufacturer of apparatus we use uses the same power steering components that our Max and Internationals use. We use a lot of Max Internationals and Sterlings, which was no longer in business. So a lot of the components I try to keep the same throughout the whole fleet.
To the point then, Donnie, let's stay with the electrical area for a second. Batteries and alternator. Not, again, for the listeners, you know, we're not endorsing this, saying if you've got another brand, you know, go out at, you know, this afternoon and tear out what you got and go buy this. But again, for the size of your fleet, Don, what by brand, alternator and batteries, what ones have you used, and what are you standardizing on currently based on your experience?
Well, we've been using Napa batteries for years, and we use some Interstate batteries. And we're trying to compare, and we get very good life out of our batteries, which is surprising, it being emergency services. On the police side, I had the biggest issue with batteries, police and EMS. And then, like I said, we're trying Napas, we're trying Interstates, I'm trying different cranking amps, cold cranking amps, just to see what we get the best life out of. And I really haven't noticed a big difference. From what I've been told, I never can get a straight answer. There's only three major battery manufacturers in the U.S., and they're all pretty much what I found is equal. Now, the alternators, we got a little bit of mix of everything. And I haven't noticed any major issues with alternators.
Okay. For your pumpers, Donnie, no matter what the brand is, what amp output are you running on those that you've had good experience with?
270 to 320 amps.
Okay.
And I
understand, just again, for the benefit of our listeners that I'm familiar with, most of your fleet is pretty well laid out with LED lights. You're not using a combination of different kind of lighting?
Well, the newest rig we just took delivery in July has all LED. Prior to that, it was a mixture of strobes, LEDs, and a couple halogen here and there. And pretty much the halogens are all gone now, except on one engine, our oldest reserve engine. And that's like you were bringing up, Tom. I can remember back in the 70s, we ran 160-amp alternators with all halogen lights, and the rigs would go dead half the time. Now we're using all LEDs with 320-amp alternators. The computers that are running on the truck today, but there shouldn't be any issues. I haven't noticed any issues because of the lower consumption of power and the higher radiage.
Donnie, I really appreciate that commentary because, again, for purposes of our listeners, what Mike and I have noticed when we are engaged with departments to review bid specifications, that with the strong advent of LED lighting and now in just about every location you can think of on the fire truck, from the normal, DOT running lights, obviously all the emergency lights, compartment lighting, where strip lighting is becoming more and more common and much more cost-effective than it was even 2 or 3 years ago. I can recall back even 3 years ago with people up at the forefront wanting to put LED strip lights in the compartments and then being quoted at like $400 to $450 per compartment. Now that dollar value can put LED lights in the compartments in every compartment on your vehicle. And what we find is that people are not trying to sync up the alternator size and capacity through requiring an electrical load analysis with the bid to what is actually on the vehicle. And in some cases, because the salespeople are trying to sell and promote what they think you might want or what they have that's neat and unique, we see specs coming out with dual 270 or dual 320-amp alternators that it just looks like, wow, I just bought a 2,250 GPM fire pump. Why wouldn't I want to buy the biggest alternator? And you find out that it's either something specific to that vendor that no one else can do, or you're paying a lot of money for something that you really don't get the performance on. Don, that's why I find that it's interesting about, you mentioned about the Napa batteries. Most of the custom chassis folks use a brand of battery for the people that get the bid and the contract award. So they might be using brand A this year and another brand the following year. On your municipal fleet, Donnie, for our listeners that use commercial cabs and chassis, with, say, your Navistar fleet, are there the same year-to-year differences in brands and models in the electrical area that we see on custom chassis, or is that a little bit more stable? If you looked at a 4-year-old Navistar versus one that you bought last year, brand of batteries and what they offer the same, or does that change as well?
They change as well, because the manufacturers are buying per year, or getting quotes, or to going out to the battery manufacturer and saying, I need 8,000 batteries at 900 cold cranking amps, you know, group 31s, what price can you give me? And whoever has the lowest bid, I've noticed with International or Navistar, is here it is. With the Macs, which our fleet is predominantly Mac and International, Mac uses a lot of Exides. And it all comes down, from what I've been told from people at International, is whoever gives us the best price. Lost my train of thought here. But we've been using, you're saying about the LED lighting, we've been using it well over 10 years. I've been, when it first came out, I started specking it on all our equipment.
Yeah, no, I think.
How has that worked out for you, by the way, anyway, Donnie?
Pardon?
Using the LEDs over the regular halogen lights.
How are they working out?
Yes.
Very well. We have less issues with the LEDs compared to the halogens. And when they first came out on the transportation side, there was a lifetime warranty on LEDs. I don't know if many people are aware of that, but on the back of the lights are stamped a code that you can tell whether what the warranty is on that light. But I have very little issues with LEDs.
For the benefit of our listeners, Donnie just made a great point. If you're when you're buying or specking out a piece of fire apparatus, unlike the situation with batteries or alternators, it might be a lot more standard. Just about every vendor, apparatus manufacturer, can give you a choice by brand of what kind of LED lighting you want, and it really is not all equal. There are some lighting or lighting packages, when you go talk to the vendors at a show, that, you know, you say, well, how much is this light bar? You're going to pay more money than the apparatus manufacturer is going to, because they're buying those things in larger quantities. But that's certainly worthwhile to investigate. Donnie, I didn't know that, realizing that there were some LED lights that had different warranties. With respect to units, when they come into your shop, what types of things under normal conditions do you send out to a vendor that, either based on your staffing levels or how busy you are, that you have to sit there momentarily, scratch, in my case, your balding head, and say, okay, hey, I can't handle this, I got to send it to an outside vendor. So what types of things do you do in-house versus routinely having to send out?
Well, due to my limited staff, we do RPMs here. Brake jobs we do here. We'll do a clutch. Most of our fleet now is all automatics. That's even in municipal trucks. I won't get into the main, well, the same reason we had to go fire apparatus, we had to go automatic. Engine work and transmission work I send out. And the biggest reason we have to send the engine work out is because for us to invest in the software for each individual engine, as often as we buy trucks, the cost per factor is not there. It's cheaper for us to send it out than buy the software each time.
Okay. In your apparatus fleet, Donnie, how many different brands and models of engines of power plants do you currently have in your fleet there?
I have the big three, Cummins, Cat, and Detroit.
Okay, well, you touched all the bases there.
Yes, and, well, the newest engine has a Cummins in it, which we bought the motor 2 years prior to getting a piece of apparatus. We bought the motor, our vendor we deal with a lot, came to us and said, you're a good customer. Are you planning on buying a rig in the future? If so, we bought X amount of motors. If you buy a motor, we'll warehouse it till you're ready to buy the apparatus, which we beat the EPA 2010, which worked out great for us. Well, great for me, put it that way. Our older apparatus has Detroits, and we had 1 year that was an issue with Detroit, and we got a Caterpillar. and I had had no issues at all with the Caterpillar. Now, in the municipal fleet, we have a run internationals. The latest dump truck we got this summer, we've been having a lot of issues with the EPA, EGR, software upgrades. The truck's actually been at the dealer more than it has been on the road.
And what GVW range are we talking about on that one, Donnie?
That truck is a 41,000 GVW. It's a dump truck. The engine is a 350 horsepower workhorse motor.
Okay, so it sounds like then in your fire truck fleet, you've been fortunate because of some very progressive thinking. That I take it, reading in between the lines, you don't have any 2010 EPA compliant diesel engines in your apparatus fleet currently, but you certainly do on the municipal side.
Correct. I was trying to think way far ahead when I knew what was coming down the road, and we bought that motor for apparatus. The next
I think we're so fortunate. Without a doubt, I think based on some of the interaction that Mike and I have had with folks, either with inquiries to our the emergency vehicle response website or meeting people out on the road, that there are more than just a handful of stories, and most of them you classify as, you know, being in the horror section of things that have happened that have on the apparatus side that have left a lot of people puzzled and figuring out what to try to do. Just last question before we take a break. With the myriad of the sounds like all the different brands of diesel engines that you have, did you have to do anything unique to establish a rapport or relationship with the different outside vendors that would service these? Understanding that, again, for our listeners that aren't familiar with Don's location in the suburban metro Harrisburg area, state capital, quite built up, have pretty good access. It's not like, you know, we're out on the range in the middle of North Dakota and we're 200 miles away from the nearest diesel mechanic. So he does, as I say, I guess in a movie, he's got that going for him. But was there anything in particular you needed to do, Don, or with some of the issues that you've had working through these with people to, you know, establish a rapport with the outside shop other than just knocking on the door and saying, hey, I'm Don Gutschall from Hamden Township. Could you help me out?
No, we have a pretty good rapport of all our vendors in this area. And as far as the Harrisburg area being a major transportation hub for the Northeast, everybody's in this area to service the heavy-duty side of a fleet, especially in the fire apparatus. And all major fire apparatus vendors have shops in this Harrisburg area. So we're very fortunate in this area.
With the work with the outside vendors, Donnie, on the fire truck side, again, because of what you had just intimated, that it's a major transportation hub. You probably go into any one of these shops, and there's something in every bay, and they've got stuff sitting outside year-round. It's not like they've got mechanics waiting around, leaning against the doorpost, waiting for somebody to bring in a Class A tractor that's got some issues. Did you have to do anything special when it came time on the fire or the EMS side to make sure that they would give your vehicles a kind of higher priority and not just, you know, take a ticket and, you know, wait in line for your turn at the counter?
No, the vendors in the Harrisburg area are very accommodating to the emergency services. Very rarely, once in a while on an EMS rig, I'll have to wait a day to get it in. And that's the debacle of EPA, the 6.0 liter diesel. But other on fire apparatus in the Harrisburg area, they more or less bend over backwards to get you in. I've never had any issues. But then I have a good rapport.
That's good to hear. And I think, again, it goes to the credit that you're talking to the people as a mechanic and can talk to them face-to-face, and I think in some cases departments where they've alleged that they've not been treated fairly or improperly, it's that sometimes they just haven't, made the inroads and laid the groundwork for what their expectations are and to be able to establish that rapport. So I think based largely just on your geography, like you say, you're fortunate. You're at the major crossroads of 83 and 81. If you go down in that area, you see trucking terminals all over the place with just about virtually every brand. So there's probably one of the very few areas of the country where you can get that level of service. So, hey, we're going to take a break. Our guest today is Don Gutchall, fleet manager in charge of maintenance for Hamden Township, Pennsylvania, and the Hamden Township Fire Department. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shanley, Apparatus Architects. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hey, we're back. It's the Apparatus Architects from Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan. Your good Lieutenant Wilbur's probably got his little ski cap and gloves on, and I do as well, because where we're at, it's cold. Where our guest is today, Mr. Don Gutchall, fleet manager from Hamden Township, PA. I'm sure it's probably about 85 degrees, and Don's got the sunscreen on because he lives in Pennsylvania. So, Donnie, coming back, we mentioned just before the break, talked about pumps just briefly. And I know with your four engines and the units that you've had that are now, in Hamden Township's past history, what brand of pump do you run, and what kind of normal PM maintenance are you giving there? Because one of the things that Mike and I are seeing, just from an overall perspective, not just fire pumps, but with municipal budgets being what they are, and they're looking to try to grab monies to try to, as they say, pinch pennies, unfortunately, in some locations, the maintenance budget has been one that's taken the hit, because people feel like, okay, we're not going to spend the money, and they forget about how important the word preventative is. We'll fix it when it breaks. If it doesn't break, if the door doesn't come off when I open it, then I guess the door is still working fine, and they kind of just keep trucking on. So what types of things do you do to keep your pumper engine fleet up and running well?
Well, when we do the annual PM, we drain the transfer case oil and change that on all the pumps. Check the packing regularly. Now, on the last three engines, we have gotten mechanical packing, so there's no more what I call the rag packing in there. I only have one of them left. We run Hales, and we have one Watrous left, and we'd have had Darley. So we've had a little bit of everything here. So now I'm down
all
to
right,
go ahead.
With the mechanical seals, Donnie, again, that there seems to be a big divergence of opinion. People either saying they love them and they haven't had any issues with them. I've heard, and again, based on your mechanical background, I would like your feedback on this. People have said, well, hey, they run great until, you run the pump dry for just a little bit and then they crack and now we've got more problems and, they kind of go back. It's like old school. Well, we know what we're doing with the packing, but we don't seem to have a handle on what we're doing with the mechanical seals. So what would your, if somebody threw that argument at you, what would your comeback be?
Well, I guess it's a lot of preferences, but my personal opinion is if you train your operators properly, you shouldn't be having a dry pump issue. And I also try to protect the rig by having automatic thermal reliefs. So in case the operator doesn't open the tank to pump and then pump the tank valves, it automatically does it and it keeps the pump water at a cooler rate, plus it keeps water in the pump, and we keep our pumps wet year-round. The old rag packing, it's time-consuming, it's not cost-effective. It takes hours sometimes. If it doesn't blow out when you try it the first time, you're sitting there for hours picking at it to replace it. You also can score a shaft. You're spinning. If you got the pump too hot and you got the old old rag packing, it'll score a shaft. Where the mechanical packing, on the mechanic side, if they're familiar, the old Detroits, it's the same kind of water pump seal that's on the old Detroits. And they ran forever. And plus, on a hail pump, you have the auto lube on the front, so you have no packing in the front end. So it puts your cost for operation down.
I think that's some great insight there. With respect to the you mentioned about if you train your operators properly, do you have, or how does Hamden Township train and their engineers or their pump operators? Do you get involved with that aspect at all, or do you assist with the department's training officer to provide them some guidance if that's needed?
Oh yes, I go to at least one training a year that I have for them that I attend to show them and go over everything on a rig for the operators and re-update them on any changes that might have been made. And when a new piece of apparatus comes, not only does the dealer do some training, I also do the training with them and give them more training to make sure. I try to eliminate work for myself. I have enough on my plate.
Question often, Donnie, about two-stage versus single-stage pumps. Well, what are you guys running?
Well, right now we're running, I have two 2,000 GPM two-stage pumps and a 1750 single-stage and a 1500 single-stage on the latest engine. The reasoning at the time of the purchase of the two engines with the two-stage pumps, at that time we had very low water pressure and some of our water sources were not very good. And to supply our tower ladder, which does not have a pump, it's a truck, my theory was I can get in two-stage, I can get the 1,000 GPM to the tip, which is half the capacity of the pump, and that was the theory. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but I figured we get 1,000 gallons to the rig, I can at least get it at full elevation, the proper amount of GPM to the tip.
No, I think that's good logic.
Yes, and they also on the two stages, on a standard firefighting operation, if you have it in pressure mode, your engine is not working as hard as you are on a single stage.
So with your newest unit then, Donnie, correct me if I'm wrong, you said your newest unit was a single stage?
Yes, it is. They have upped our water pressures over 60 PSI here in the last year and a half, 2 years.
From a firefighting perspective, are your units then having the draft on you? It sounds like the majority of times you've got a municipal water system, so the quality of the water is, you know, somewhat reasonable?
Yes. In the last 5 years, we went from a couple places that we've had a draft and used tanker operations to mostly being covered by hydrants in the last 5 years. So we have really progressed on the water supply side of our area.
So beyond talking about the with the seals, what type of valves do you use, or what ones have you had the best experience with?
Most of our valves or Akron. There's an Elkhart here and there. Use Hale MIVs on the new engines on the intakes, which I've had no issues with at all. The Akrons, I have not had any problems. Now, some of the older Akrons, I believe it was the 8800 series, they were totally stainless steel. There was a couple of departments had a lot of issues with them. I steered away from them, dealing with our vendors. Giving me heads up, no, you don't want them. Another thing we went to is a Trident air primer for the priming device, and I've gotten nothing but very positive feedback on that.
Well, I appreciate bringing up the issue about the air primer. That's something that I picked up on, again, from folks from the outside back a couple of years ago, and it's kind of like valves if you think about it. Talking to an old, crusty mechanic, a number of years ago, that was complaining because they had like virtually every brand of valve ever known to man in his fleet, and the ones that he liked were not the ones that the department was specking. And he just looked at me and said, "Tom, how many years have we had valves discharge and intake valves on fire trucks, and we still haven't been able to figure out how to build one that works or a water system where they had some low-lift artesian wells, and they had a lot of sand in this water system, and it would eat up the surface of the ball valves. So it was interesting, Donnie, when you mentioned about stainless steel that we had, you know, people called it Teflon. There's different variations of that. There was, you know, ones that had had a brass manufacturer that was really pretty bulletproof, but that valve wasn't available always in the different sizes that you needed. And people went to stainless steel for a while, like you said, and that was looked to be the panacea, and pretty shortly that turned out to be, that's not, you know, you just paid more money to get what you thought was the best, and you ended up with more headaches than you ever had hoped for. So it sounds like you've got that part of your
back to the valves, on the intake valves, I mean, years ago we used the piston intake valves, and they were aluminum, and we have very hard water in this area. And switching to the MIV valves, which is basically a butterfly valve, we've had zero issues.
You know, it's interesting on the MIV valve, you know, and there's a couple of different versions of that. But most recently I have heard commentary from folks that have those that said that one of their issues were that it needed to be exercised, you know, frequently. And that frequently didn't mean, you know, at the annual pump test or once a month, that when they did operate them that weren't exercised where they had issues. So again, it sounds to me, I think, Donnie, that it's a combination of the department playing heads up with what they're doing with your input on the spec side, and I think most importantly for the listeners on the maintenance side, you're keeping on top of this stuff, that a lot of things that we have heard common complaints with, that you've got well under control. So hats off to you on that. And from just an overall perspective, anything that you have tried, knowing that, again, in the past, Hamden Township's been a very progressive, you know, not only at a township level, but certainly at a fire department level. Anything that you have tried or experimented with, again, kind of putting you on the spot here, that you tried and thought was a great idea and said, you know, had tried it, but I don't think we would go back for, you know, we wouldn't come back for the second performance of that.
Offhand, there's a lot of widgets that was bought over the years, a couple prior chiefs, but overall, there's nothing we have actually done that didn't work and that we're ashamed of. We try to keep it, my philosophy is simple, stupid. Especially in the fire service today, I think guys get over technical on a lot of things. And back to your training, another thing when I have my training with the operators each year is I tell them, if they're standing in the station just shooting a bull, to walk over the rig while they're standing there and exercise the valves, just to exercise them, just to keep them loose, especially with the hard water.
So, I would take it then, we haven't broached the subject, but that it's under your jurisdiction then to do the annual pump test on the vehicles as well?
Yes, it is.
So, there's another thing where I think with having the expertise that you bring the bear there, it gives you another opportunity to really look at the rig while it's performing, where I think a lot of departments, I guess it's one of the things I look at as somewhat old school, but sad to say, you know, back in the day when I started, a department, just about everybody that I knew did their own pump test, had somebody within the department that, you know, that had the knowledge how to do it. Even if they didn't have the equipment, they maybe borrowed it from another bigger department. But it was at least once a year that a group of people, you know, had a direct hands-on opportunity to operate all of the, you know, every component that's in that 45 to 50 inch space on the panel, and see if everything was performing properly. Today, there's a lot of departments, I guess you have to say, to a point, God bless them, They contract that out, and it's just like, well, you know, we don't do hose testing, you know, which that arguably is not the greatest thing to do. You know, we contract out all our ground ladder and our aerial testing, and oh yeah, we contract out our pump testing too. And they've lost contact of being able to get that hands on the vehicle. And the only time they operate is at a training session. And then sometimes my experience has been that the people are questioning, well, this thing ain't operating correctly. And the reason it's not operating correctly is because they don't know how to operate it correctly. And it may actually be doing exactly what it's supposed to do, but nobody trained them how to operate the damn thing.
And I'm very fortunate when I do a pump test here lately, a lot of the operators will come out to the pump test, and I'll make them do the drafting and do the hands-on, and I'm basically watching the gauges and telling them what to do, so they get the experience.
Now, I think that's
I think just to throw in here too, just from a firefighter perspective, when we did hose testing, not only from a pump operator's point of view, but even as a firefighter's point of view, we learned an awful lot about the equipment and what you could do and what you couldn't do. And I guess some departments that hire that out tend to think that it's busy work testing hose, and that it's saving guys and man hours or something like that. But again, some of the more progressive departments look at hose testing as really a training opportunity. And I think a lot of people are missing the boat on that now.
Well, there was one occurrence that Mike and I had within the last 18 months, and the department will go nameless, but a department that, again, they had the resources to contract out the pump testing. The vehicle was not there the day that we were to do some work, but it was coming back later that afternoon. Well, it comes back later that afternoon from the folks that were doing the pump testing saying we couldn't get the pump to engage. All right, it wouldn't make the transfer from road into pump, and then there were some other associated electrical issues. Well, then that kind of got me thinking. I said, all right, well, that occurred while they were trying to, you know, the outside vendor was trying to do the pump test. I wonder how long it has been impossible for that one particular piece of apparatus to be functional. And it just, again, it's one of those things that, if the department had kept up on top of the on top of everything they do and had been intimate in that, they maybe would have found it sooner. You know, it ended up, it had to go out to the local, they believed it was a problem with the ECU and the interface between that and the fire pump. And, you know, the thing goes off and people say, well, you know, we're just going to go get it fixed. Again, they've kind of lost contact with how things are. So
I like to have a hands-on in the pump testing along with the operators, or the engineers, as some people call them. If there is an issue, I can pick it up right away, and I know what's going on with the rig, instead of a vendor saying, oh, well, you have this issue, and you really wonder, do you or do not, don't you? But if you're there and witness it, and back to the pump testing, is how many departments actually witness when they get a new piece of equipment, the pump test for the certification when the rig is new.
I'll tell you, there's horror stories out there, Don, that are many of departments that have purchased new apparatus, and because it comes with the complimentary UL sticker on it, they believe that everything is just true and tried and up to speed. And I can't urge people, from the stories that we have heard, I can't urge them strongly enough that when you take delivery of whether it's a new piece of hose or whether it's a new pumper, that you do the testing on it before you put it in service. That NFPA acceptance test, you can go to the NFPA handbook and get the tolerances out to do that. But one time there was a group that bought a pumper, 1250 pump, that would only do 755, and it ended up that the manufacturer had taken a commercial chassis and hooked the pump up to pump in fourth gear instead of fifth. Once they straightened that around, the 1250 pump did 1,800 gallons per minute. But had this department not done that acceptance testing before they took delivery, they would have paid for a 1250 pumper that would have only done 755 gallons a minute and probably would have gone out of warranty and been none the wiser for a very long time. And it was delivered that way. So I think acceptance testing is really a key issue.
Yeah. I'm there when they do it. I want to see what that rig is going to do, and it's brand new, so I can compare it down the road.
Yeah, I think that's, it's the types of things depending upon where you go and where your new apparatus is being manufactured. Mike and I have written about this and commented previously, but Donnie brings this home, is that for those of you that think that, you know, the inspection process is just going to be a fun trip, that we're going to go out to, you know, go play golf and, you know, go tour the factory, look at other people's fire trucks and give our rig the cursory once over, it's a working inspection. And even if you can't, just because of logistics, a bid that we're reviewing for a department, we asked for the inspection trips to be done at specific times and for the bidders to identify what cost they built in to their bid price for the inspection trips. So that would be called out, and you could equalize and pretty easily then determine what actually the fire truck is costing. But where, you know, you find yourself just from a logistical standpoint that you can't be there the day that the UL test is actually done, because that's going to be done at the, obviously, at the manufacturer's convenience, and you're not going to be able to potentially tell them, well, I can't make it on Tuesday, but I could be there on Saturday. I mean, they're not going to do something like that. If you cannot witness the test yourself, as Donnie intimated, then during your final inspection, you certainly want to take that unit with prior arrangements and take it out to their pump test location and at least do a mini version service test of it to ensure that the rig is going to perform, which then goes to Mike's point. So there's a bunch of different ways in which to accomplish the goal, depending upon your resources and obviously the distances involved from where you are to, you know, who's building your fire truck.
And so I have done that, Tom. I have taken a final inspection that I wasn't able to witness the actual pump test once. We took it up to the pump test building and made them do.
Yeah, and again, that's the kind of thing. Again, you have to say with prior arrangements. If you're dealing with a large manufacturer that's building a lot of vehicles each month, they'll be more than happy to accommodate that. And I've done that on numerous occasions. But you need to tell them that ahead of time. You can't at 11:30, you know, let them know, say, hey, when we come back from our hamburger lunch at 1 o'clock, I want to take the unit out on the test pad, because they probably have other, you know, production and manufacturing issues. But I have never worked with any one of the major manufacturers that was not able to accommodate that request when they knew it ahead of time. And again, you're doing that for your protection. You know, fire apparatus goes without saying. It always was a major investment, but now it's more of a major investment. And if you ever had to then go to the mat with your local community to get the financial resources lined up to go buy a new fire truck, you want to make pretty sure that when that vehicle comes in the town, that whatever issues are identified at your final inspection are going to have been rectified. You're going to weigh the unit after you get your hose and equipment on it and make sure it's within the axle ratings front and rear and overall. And hopefully you've had enough foresight, if you've run in intercoms or radio headset systems, well, when that's installed, other than putting water in a tank and your equipment on a vehicle, you then train the people and you're ready to go. It will eliminate some of the horror stories that Mike alluded to, that the vehicle shows up in a town and is overweight. In some cases, we found, you know, units that don't fit and a whole bunch of other things. So, Donnie, we're very appreciative. Any final thoughts here before we wrap up today? But our guest has been Don Gutschall, fleet manager for Hampden Township, Pennsylvania, in Cumberland County, a longtime good friend of Mike's and mine, and we're very, very appreciative of Donnie taking time out from his busy day to be able to be our guest here this month. So, Donnie, any parting thoughts?
No, I just want to thank you guys very much for having me on the show. I appreciate it. And I just wish everybody be safe out there this year, and hope they have no problems.
And if they do, you can write them in to Mike and Tom at our website at emergencyvehiclerespons.com, and if it's out of our area, now everyone knows. Donnie is one of our good friends and go-to people. He's helped us out of things when we're left scratching our heads trying to figure out what to do. So, that Mike, any parting thoughts?
Yeah, I just want to thank Donnie and again reiterate that we wish everybody a very safe, happy, and healthy 2012 as we move forward.
Well, that's going to wrap up our first show of the year. Again, to our listeners, very appreciative for the feedback that you've given us. And anyone that has questions, they can write it into podcast@firehouse.com or through our website, emergencyvehiclerespons.com. For Mike Wilbur and our guest, Don Gutchell, this is Tom Shan. We're the Apparatus Architects. Until the next time, be well and stay safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.